Welcome to the EU Startups Podcast. Sit back and enjoy the show hosted by Marcin Lewandowski.
EU Startups Podcast is brought to you by Vonta. If you're building a SaaS business, achieving compliance with SOC 2, ISO 27001, or other in-demand frameworks can unlock major growth for your company and establish customer trust. However, this process is often time-intensive and costly. Vonta automates your compliance work, getting you audit ready quickly and saving you up to 85% of associated costs. And Vonta scales with your business, helping you continuously monitor compliance, unify risk management, and streamline security reviews. Join 8,000 global companies like Synethia, Flow Health, and Alica Bank that use Vonta to build trust and prove security in real time. Our audience gets a special offer of $1,000 off Vonta at vonta.com/EU startups. That's vonta.com/EU startups.
Hey everyone, this is Marcin Lewandowski and you're listening to the EU Startups Podcast. My guest today is Peter Hirsch. Peter is a head of sustainability at 2150. 2150 is a venture capital firm investing in technology companies that seek to sustainably reimagine and reshape cities and the industries that power them. They're part of Urban Partners, a platform of vision-aligned, differentiated investment strategies shaped around urban problem-solving. Peter, welcome to the show. It's a great pleasure to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me.
Amazing. Peter, so let's jump right on it. You've championed a 100 euro carbon tax across all scopes at 2150. What did the internal discussion look like to implement that? And how do you convince other VCs to follow?
Yeah, thanks so much for diving right into the details, because I think that is something that sort of differentiates our fund a bit. Before I get onto the carbon tax, maybe I should just give a little bit of context for like what is a head of sustainability, and then why do we even get to the part of talking about a carbon tax?
Yes, sir. Tell
us. So as a head of sustainability at a venture capital fund, we as 2150 have this, as you noted, this focus on urban sustainability. What we're looking to do is truly like maximize impact through our investments as much as we maximize financial returns. Mm-hmm. And in that, we are backing specifically climate solutions in those companies that are helping to solve the most critical environmental challenges of cities. Yeah. So impact is central to what we do, and it's a part of our due diligence. It's a part of how we interact with companies. And so essentially, whatever we do as a fund, we have to make sure that it meets that mission. There's obviously the financial side of venture, which is core to anyone's operations. But since we have this dual
return
this,
the money to your
yeah that and hopefully more, but we have this dual mission that we want to create value both in terms of financial value and in terms of impactful value. Mm-hmm. So when we look at how we engage with companies, how we engage with investments, and then how we engage in our own operations, we're looking to understand how we can maximize that impact. And so the carbon tax came about as a part of that conversation about thinking about sustainability holistically, not only through our investments, but how we function as a fund. Yeah. So typically, like as a fund, so we measure all of our scope 1 through 3 emissions. We understand that roughly how much we emit per year from our sort of management company. And we understand that many funds or other corporations, I should say, or just companies, look to offsetting or ways of basically being able to address those emissions that they still have. In the climate tech space that we're focused on, we're acutely aware that there's a couple of things going on. First is that the quality of really high quality supply of carbon credits, things that are ideally removing tons of CO2 from the atmosphere, are really providing deeply meaningful and durable carbon solutions is limited. So for us to then go out to the market and take this limited supply, is that the best use of our funding? The second question then came also, if we were to go out and buy those credits, is that potentially going after the sectors that we would want to be investing anyway? We have a couple of companies in our portfolio that deal in either direct carbon removal. So we have a direct air capture company in the portfolio, Mission Zero. Mm-hmm. We have Carbon Cure, which is directly sequestering CO2 into concrete and permanently affixing it there. Both of those are part of the portfolio and part of our financial strategy. we're not being terribly additional and necessarily that impactful if we go out and try to find those same solutions that we might invest in with our normal capital. So then the carbon tax is a way of us being able to both address our the impacts of our externalities being our emissions, but also find a way of being able to channel our funding and resources towards those missions and ultimately solutions that we think are helping to build this durable supply of quality credits. So we apply that 100 euro ton carbon tax to everything we do, scope 1 through 3. And then we provide it as grants to nature-based solutions projects. So these are projects that are having both carbon climate mitigation and biodiversity benefits. And in that, it's a use of resources that we would never be able to do typically as a climate tech fund focused on urban sustainability. But here we can have much more reach with our dollars and go beyond the mission of what we just typically do in our sort of day-to-day operations.
Sounds good, Peter. I like how your position is called Head of Sustainability. Sounds fancy, but also sounds like there's a lot of responsibility to it. Peter, investing in both, you know, decarbonizing industries and moonshot tech sounds ambitious, given the venture capital nature. How do you actually strike a balance between immediate impact and, you know, deep tech innovations that require some more time to mature and commercialize and generally make it work?
Yeah, I think one of the best ways to think about this sort of dual mission, right? We want to decarbonize as quickly as possible. We want to decarbonize in a way that is really durable and helps to get us all the way to net zero, right? So there's this roadmap that the IEA puts out to help us sort of guide how are we actually going to get to net zero by 2050, their 1.5 degree pathway. And in the most recent version, they found that there's still about 34% of technologies needed to realize net zero by 2050 that are still considered in what they call under development. So that means that there's this cohort of technologies that isn't at maturity yet and needs the type of support and innovation in order to get to that level of fully scaled up and deployed where it can actually see through the net zero transition all the way. Mm-hmm. So I guess our full net zero transition or journey is not purely a question of how fast we can deploy and mature technologies. It's also how we can innovate and deploy new solutions. So our focus as a fund is to solve the many challenges cities face to see through their sustainable transformation. Our portfolio and the solutions we back can be understood in some ways of finding those impactful, scalable, and venture-backable opportunities to solve these many challenges. Mm-hmm. So in some cases, it's about integrating mature technologies into urban systems. One of our companies, 1,5, Ein,5 in German, is helping to roll out really mature technologies like PV, heat pumps, storage, chargers into homes. This is tech that's ready now, and the innovation and really their huge value add is how they're helping to bring that to market and help get it integrated as quickly as possible. And then other parts of our portfolio is talking about longer term transformation. And these are in industries like concrete and cement, or even in new innovations like cooling with one of our companies, Blue Frontier, which is completely rethinking the way that we develop air conditioners and space cooling, which really hasn't seen that much innovation for about 100 years. So I guess with that understanding that cities need so many different ways to be able to solve the specific, I guess, sectoral or infrastructure or energy or challenges that are a part of what will be their sustainable transformation, our portfolio is then as much a reflection of that multi-layered approach to solving each of those challenges as it is to thinking long-term carbon and then short-term carbon.
Sounds good, Peter. Since we're already here, let's talk about the urban stack. It's often overlooked, right? Yet central to your investment thesis. What's the most surprising opportunity or challenge you faced in, you know, reshaping cities for a sustainable future?
Yeah, so I think, personally, I've worked with cities for a while. It's only with 2150. My previous role, I was in a development bank focused on project finance for largely urban infrastructure. So I was always dealing with city officials, city planning, and how they're really thinking about supporting their wider net zero journey. By working with cities for that amount of time, I think what you can realize is the agility and ambition that can come in cities that can't happen necessarily at a national scale cities can move quickly, right? They can make decisions. They can act at the sort of a vanguard of what could be the newest solutions and the newest ways of operating faster than national governments can. In the US, we've seen evidence of this in New York with a lot laws like LL97, which is actually providing a carbon price on emissions from the largest buildings in New York, has really driven the thoughts for and the ambition of many to start thinking about deep energy retrofits. So I think that's the really exciting part of working sort of in the urban stack, is that you can have these sort of like test beds of innovation, and you'd have city leaders that can move in ways that is really conducive to venture capital, given that this is early stage and we're trying to get these new types of thinking and new types of operating into the ground as quickly as possible. But I think the other part of your question, though, is like, what are some of the challenges of working with cities? Yeah. And there, I think we have to understand is that, sure, that cities might be able to move fast and be innovative, but also urban systems are deeply entrenched and fragmented, right? Mm-hmm. So when you think about the built environment, when you think about even the grid or transport system, these are distributed assets where like single innovations or single large investments aren't going to be able to solve the vast impacts that they have.
Yeah.
So if you want to see through, this is like the energy retrofits of buildings or increase their energy efficiency or even reduce the embodied emissions of construction, you need to do that asset by asset. And that's where this, I guess, challenge of thinking really at the urban scale comes in, that it's going to have to be solutions that are adaptable, flexible, but also ubiquitous, that are able to meet this demand that cities have, like a there's deeply personal experiences in many ways, but large conglomerations of wide sectors and others.
Sounds good, Peter. Looking 10 years ahead, your portfolio is, you know, projected to avoid or remove 10 plus million tons of CO2. What innovations do you think will lead that that charge? And how realistic is this outcome?
Yeah, thanks for doing it. So quick shout out to our impact report. So every single year we put out an impact report that shows both the performance of our portfolio and then where we think it might be able to get in the next 10 years. So we develop that 10-year projection on what we call a planned impact approach. This is pulling from the methodology that Project Frame has helped to put together. Yeah. And so with each portfolio company, we develop a planned impact model, which is built off of their financial model. So an understanding of how big a company could be by a certain date. And if they're that large by that time, what does that mean in terms of impact? So that means it really, really links the growth of their product and the type of impact that their product actually provides to the ultimate portfolio aggregated level of impact that we're communicating, that a 10 plus million tons of CO2 within 10 years. So I think in order to see through that, then we need to see through the full scaling and maturity and then adoption of our company's solutions and their wider business models. So across the portfolio, if you want to be able to see that type of outcome, we need to see true innovations in building energy systems, in concrete and cement, in cooling, windows, even in direct air capture. Yeah. It's many different ways that's going to see that overarching goal of getting to that level of mitigation. But it's certainly something that like we are making these bets in all of these different sectors, because we truly believe that these are the specific solutions that are going to be able to be successful in the respective industries, as well as the ones that have the ability to scale at that pace.
Peter, if you could redesign one city from scratch with the clean tech solutions of today or tomorrow, what would that city look like?
Yeah, this is a great question, in that I think that it's a perfect question for sort of like an urban planner that always loves to think sort of like, if in a perfect world, what could you do? Like, no rules. And I think this sort of theoretical thinking definitely sort of speaks to some of the world that we live in, in the connections that we have to this like wider urban systems thinking. And I think it's exactly that last part that I think the ideal city would start to be built off of. That when you start thinking at the scale of a city, not the scale of a building or the scale of a single transport hub, You have to think about what do you have in terms of proximity to essential services and opportunities for collaboration, right? Yes. Cities are drivers of economic growth, but that comes from their ability to actually have economies, which means interactions of people and interactions of commerce. So a city that really is an idealized form is one that can start thinking at that sort of like multi-strategy level. And so personally speaking, I live in a mixed-use development in London where it layers housing with public amenities, restaurants, green spaces, and all that is quick proximity to markets and transport. So while I'm not advocating that everyone lives in central London, what I am trying to do is if you can think about cities and hope that anyone would be able to achieve this, is that they can access, or not achieve this, I should say, but anyone is able to enjoy this, it would be that they can access easily and sustainably the services that they need and the opportunities they need for a comfortable life. I think within that, then you have to think about, okay, how are those systems built? Are they going to be able to be fully decarbonized, likely meaning they would run on electricity? But before you start even getting down into the individual tech and how the infrastructure is going to be there, it's about how does the system itself design, how is it designed to enable the essential services that we need out of cities and the comfort that we need in order to enjoy our own lives.
Sounds exciting, Peter. And let's talk about greenwashing for a while. You know, within the VC world that you're operating, you must be careful to avoid that. How do you actually differentiate real impact from hype? And how can investors and founders navigate that, you know, thin line?
Yeah, it's definitely something that we need to be very critical about, right? We've said publicly, and we continue to support our mission, that everything that we would do as a fund will be sustainable. We have committed to 100% sustainable investments, and we continue to make that with every investment we make, and we continue to track that with our portfolio to ensure they continue to uphold that standard. So with that understanding, then greenwashing certainly is a key concern, both at the early investment stage and then at the portfolio level. I think where the key strategy that we have to sort of manage that risk is really ensuring that the companies build their value from their product that meaningfully solves an environmental issue, right? If the way that you reduce energy consumption, material consumption, emissions is actually tied to how you're generating your revenue, then your business model is inherently something that's contributing to a sustainable outcome. So what we do is we really, really drill down then whenever we do diligence a company, whenever we work with our portfolio to ensure that they can demonstrate that their product is providing that type of value. So my role is, and then the wider sustainability team often is sort of on that technical side where you could think about how does the engineering work? How does the chemistry of this work? Does this really check out? And use that science and sort of empirical evidence to be able to drive the idea that if a company really were to deploy, it would be creating value for its customers and it would be creating value for the industry that it's looking into. So in that way, if that value is there and if it's truly delivering this green impact, wider greenwashing, at least on the core aspects of the business, are something that you would be able to sort of mitigate just through that initial screening.
Got it. Peter, what was the wildest idea that you've seen which actually has a chance of transforming our planet?
Yeah, so in venture, it's a really exciting space to be in. I've been in it for a few years now, and I have to say, like, the level of just like expertise, ambition, like humbleness that I feel when sometimes in speaking to these founders that have developed these ideas that are so revolutionary that you can only imagine like how exciting it would be if they're able to get there. And not to point to our own portfolio too much when it comes to some of the wilder ideas that we've found, but like there's two that I really want to highlight, one specifically and then one more generally. So the first one is Biomason. So Biomason is a company that is completely rethinking how we make cement. Yeah. So we've been making cement for literally thousands of years, and it's been the same way of burning limestone and then the emissions from that, both from the combustion of limestone and then the heat that's needed to burn limestone, are enormous. Depending on how you cut it, it's about 4% of greenhouse gas emissions globally, 7% of just CO2 emissions. It's an incredibly emissions intensive industry. So we need to be able to think about how are you going to decarbonize this really hard to abate sector, given the wide use of cement and concrete and the need that we can't be having these emissions for that much longer. Biomason has figured out a way to use biology to circumvent the need for a traditional cement kiln. Their specific bacteria is able to be combined with limestone to be able to break it down in a non-energy intensive process to get it to something that is chemically equivalent to OPC, to ordinary Portland cement. And from there, they're able to turn that into, right now, pavers and precast concrete. So essentially concrete bricks that can be already, that have been already integrated into multiple built environments. One of the buildings actually here in London.
Yeah.
And if you think about that, just that's rethinking an entire industrial process that's been entrenched in our economic systems literally for thousands of years to change how we deliver the exact same product. At the end of the day, your concrete brick is still a concrete brick. The chemical composition of it is the same. The engineering testing of it is the same, but the way it was made is completely different. And so to be able to see through a complete rethink of a industry to still deliver the same utility, I think is really incredible to see. But I think on another way of looking at this, and this is the second company I wanted to bring up, this is Mission Zero, which is a direct air capture company within our portfolio. So on the Biomason side, it is reimagining an existing industry. In direct air capture, we are inventing a new industry, right? We have not done anything at this scale for this type of technology before. Literally pulling out CO2 from the atmosphere through industrial processes, not just through natural sequestration. So having these new ways of thinking about this and this new tech is something that I think, to sort of go back to the original question, is one of the wildest ideas that you can imagine, that we are building a whole new industry to be able to address what this legacy of CO2 that we still have in the atmosphere, acknowledging that we potentially won't be able to truly get to net zero by mitigation alone. We need to have some form of removals to balance out that equation. So that sort of longer term vision that we are going to build towards a gigaton potential industry of DAC removal, where hopefully Mission Zero is an essential part of that journey, is one where we haven't seen something at that pace and scale for any new type of truly industrial sector for a while.
Amazing, Peter. That sounds very promising. I hope that it works out, because we all really need it. let's talk for a second about the future of EU competitiveness report. I know you guys have some, maybe not strong, but shaped opinions about it already. It outlines some serious challenges for the clean tech sector. How do you think Europe stacks up against the US and China in fostering sustainable innovation?
Yeah. So I think first we were really encouraged by the ambition and the findings of Draghi's report. And we're certainly looking forward to seeing how the commission may respond. I don't know if you can tell by my accent, I'm American, but I'm based in London. We have a fund that's based between London and Copenhagen. I have a foot in the EU, a foot in the UK, I have a foot in the US. So I think sort of understanding of these sort of many different sectors or many different economies that I sort of float through, the key opportunity for Europe to remain competitive and really be a driver, particularly in our sector, so the climate tech sector, is one that's really exciting, and I see is truly essential for its economic future.
Yeah.
So the general thesis of the report, though, was that essentially without consistent and ambitious investment, Europe will slowly stagnate in comparison to other major economies. Right. So it acknowledges then that, where I think sort of this is the challenge that is acknowledged, where Europe really has a lot of strengths when it comes to its sciences, engineering, and research, but struggles quite a bit in translating or converting those strengths into globally competitive companies. So I think one of the things that we would hope to see how Europe stacks up against the US is really, as you said, being able to foster that sustainable innovation. That the skills are here, the thinking is here, the potential is here, the economic drivers, particularly for climate technologies, for sure is there, given the ambition.
The edge is lacking, right?
What?
The edge is lacking. There's no edge.
Well, I think I don't know how to. I think just as a comparison.
You're American, you know. It's actually great to hear this perspective from you, because given that probably have a great overview of the U.S. as well, and like now like being folks in Europe. Please go on. I'm just curious to hear.
No, so I mean, as an American, but I think more as a climate tech investor. Like, we've seen what the Inflation Reduction Act is able to do for that industry. The enormous amounts of investment that each dollar of public support has been able to leverage in the U.S. Really is something that should be studied. And it has been studied. Actually, we've seen it. We have a number of reports that are showing like how much this is leveraging. And so I think as Europe is understanding how it's going to remain competitive in what are rapidly developing industries in both the US and China. And at the same time, like, there's a huge demand for these types of technologies in Europe, given the policy context. Yeah. It definitely needs to think about a way to be a developer and exporter of these technologies, and not simply a taker of them. And so I think as we continue, and we'll certainly be investing in the EU and the climate tech industry for looking forward, having those development pathways, having those clear signals that these industries truly are prioritized from an economic security, from an industrial security, from a sort of just future prosperity standpoint, without even mentioning net zero, is one where I hope that this commission continues to prioritize as it develops its economic agenda.
Peter, let's talk about scope 3 emissions. Yeah, I know you mentioned them already at the beginning. So, you know, scope 3 emissions are notoriously tricky to measure and manage. What's your advice to founders trying to tackle this indirect emissions? Oftentimes, hear from the perspective, because, you know, you're an early stage startup. Yeah. Often your focus is on something else. Maybe it should be, it shouldn't be. It should always be on this as well, given the situation we are all in. But yeah, like, can be tricky. So what's your advice to founders there?
So I think there's a few ways of cutting this. I mean, just as context, we measure our scope 1-3 emissions. We ask all of our portfolio companies to measure their scope 1-3 emissions, and we provide them actually some support in their first year to get there. We understand that this is sort of best practice in the space, and that in order to onboard that from an early stage for companies, given their size, scale, and sometimes resources available, requires some external level support to be able to get over that initial hump of really understanding how am I integrating this into our own operations. But I think putting scope 3 emissions into perspective, like, why is this even something that someone should measure? Why should someone care about like what the emissions are generated from their activities, from the materials they buy to the flights that they take? And so I think understanding that you can actually have a better picture of your operations through scope 3 emissions calculations really is, I think, the way of then understanding, should this be a value driver for how I'm starting to think about my own development of the company? So often emissions are a proxy for energy intensity, right? Which directly relates to costs. So a high emissions part of your operations can often mean that's one that's, you can actually find financial savings. We have a number of companies that have seen that some of the higher emissions parts of their scope 3 emissions are ones where they might be able to shave some of the costs if they go with a different supplier or look for a different way of transporting something. All that would translate into savings. Next thing is then to think about, how are you going to determine when calculating emissions? This is what sort of you were alluding to is appropriate for a company. Mm-hmm. So since we're a climate fund and sort of an environmentally focused fund, and all of our companies are developing in this sort of clean tech space, obviously being able to lead and demonstrate with best practice as they are sort of building their value based off of their sustainability qualities is something that's in their advantage, right? So I think that looking at our own fund as in its comprehensive calculation of greenhouse gas emissions, we understand it's specific a bit to our strategy, given how early stage our companies are. But fortunately, not only for climate tech investors, And more generalist investors were a part of what's called the Venture Climate Alliance. So the Venture Climate Alliance is a group of globally leading VCs that are helping to develop the pathways and methodologies to help managers understand how they should be aligning their portfolio with net zero. Yes. Essentially, when should you be saying yes and should you be pushing for companies to adopt certain practices to be able to ultimately get them to the point where they can then develop a truly robust approach to getting to the fully net zero operations. Yep. A company of 10 people is highly dynamic, as it will probably grow quite quickly over a year. So developing just a pure net zero pathway for it from day one, it doesn't make sense, because the company that you have a year from now will look very different than the company you have right now. Mm-hmm. So the VCA and the methodology that's public and we'll be reporting against next year then defines what are the thresholds for when you should actually start measuring your scope 1, 2, or 3 emissions. Mm-hmm. And I think there it's helpful then from a more generalist perspective, how you might think about managing your own portfolio to then say, what is best practice in this space and what might be an appropriate moment for adoption for these certain practices. And then the last thing I'd mention is once you actually get into scope 3 calculation, is understanding what is initially sort of sufficiently comprehensive to understand your own scope 3 emissions. So often emissions are concentrated in a handful of activities or even suppliers. Yeah. So getting to a place where you can have a comprehensive but possibly not totally complete picture is a great place to start to identify those priority areas. Fortunately, there are some tools out there that help you actually get to this really, pretty good picture of where your scope 3 emissions are that are free. Normative, one of our portfolio companies, actually has a free version. It's called the Business Carbon Calculator. It's on their website. So it's something you're able to easily look up and then at least provide an initial assessment of where your scope 3 emissions are. But then going back to my first point, it's being able to then identify those priority areas, those chunky areas of your emissions, yeah. That may be the ones that are also driving costs in other areas, that initial assessment can really help you do, so that as you eventually build to a full, robust greenhouse gas protocol compliant calculation, you can have at least a targeted idea of where your initial mitigation efforts will focus.
Nice. Sounds good, Peter. I know that you've highlighted the importance of resilience in urban environments. What does resilience mean to you in terms of climate adaption, and how can VCs ensure their investments support long-term sustainability in the context of changing climate?
Yeah, it's such an important topic. So I think the huge mismatch of finance between mitigation and adaptation, right?
Yeah.
Like we are not, this is not VC or private equity specific. This is global, that funding for adaptation is severely lacking. And the solutions and the way that we're actually gonna be able to invest in this still have yet to be, proliferated in a way that there's many easily financeable models or solutions for that. Like there's certainly a lot of support going into adaptation projects, but not remotely at the scale of mitigation. So with that understanding then, how do we think about resilience? How do we prioritize adaptation in our own operations and portfolio? And I think fundamentally it comes down to this idea that climate risk is financial risk, right? So If you understand that as an investor, you want to understand the context in which your investments will operate both today and in the future, because you want to be able to mitigate those potentially financially adverse outcomes that would happen due to climate change. So what risks then and opportunities does a solution or business model pose? So from things like higher temperatures, water scarcity, extreme weather like flooding, even changes in technology, like the intense uptake of cooling that's going to happen, or the criticality of a critical supply of certain minerals and metals that will come from a squeeze of new green industries growing, and even carbon pricing in certain examples is truly a climate risk. When you start realizing these are financial concerns for a company, that at early due diligence and then consistent portfolio management can actually weigh on your financial projections or potential outcomes for these companies, then ideally it becomes sort of obvious that this is something that we need to think about as VCs and investors, to really support the long-term sustainability, not only of our companies in the most, I guess, obvious sense of sustainability, but I guess in the wider sense of sustainability, being both environmental, financial, social, the whole spectrum, that this is, I guess, fundamental to their own outlooks as company, the same way that you would have, I guess, traditional risk metrics.
Peter, thanks so much for this conversation. It's climate change is such an important topic. It's the biggest challenge that we're all facing right now. Honestly, I hope this podcast will contribute to people also being more aware and understanding and taking actions on their own towards helping solve the situation. Because honestly, if you're not doing anything about climate change already, then what the fuck are you doing? Peter, thanks so much. As I said, such a pleasure to have you on the show. Hope you enjoyed it as well.
Thank you so much for highlighting, like, not only climate tech, but also the EU startups ecosystem. It's great to see such a feature like this and be a part of it. So yeah, pleasure to be on.
Thanks so much, man. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Thanks so much, and I hope to talk to you soon.
Yep.
Maybe see you in London.
Have a good day.